Hey, Joe, what do you got for us tonight?
Well, tonight we're talking about the unsolved murder of John Thurman McCool. John was a World War II veteran, successful entrepreneur, and prominent businessman who operated in and around Pine Bluff, Arkansas in the 1940s and 50s. However, after pleading guilty to fraud charges and being sentenced to prison in 1956, that sterling reputation was ruined. After being released from prison in 1958, John was working hard to rebuild both his company and his reputation, that is, until his bullet-riddled body was found slumped over the wheel of his car in a cemetery outside of town.
Quiet your mind. Ever since the Earth has circled the sun, there have been fantastic tales of wonder and mystery that the fate of Hart dare not discuss. But three brave, uninformed souls have the brass to tackle every extraordinary happenstance from the modern age to the dawn of Mantis.
Welcome once again to Dawn of Mantis, true crime, mysteries, and more. Some of that tonight. Joe, Sam, how are you guys doing?
Doing good.
Wonderful.
Some of the more tonight, right? Or is it? No, this is true crime.
Yeah, this is true crime.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Sorry.
I think the one in the pipe for the next few days is going to be the more.
Okay. That works.
It's going to be a fun one.
You know, I'll be honest. I love true crime. I love the little guessing game at the end. It's all good. But my favorite is the more. Because it's always something random, even though we're not doing more. I'm not even sure why I'm talking about that. But speaking of more, here's some more for you. Sam has something for the beginning of the episode.
Yeah, I was just going to ask you guys, not on like a super hot day, but a day like today. It's pretty nice outside.
Sure.
You know, it's in the 60s, 70s.
Yeah.
I was doing some work out there. I came in. I had me like a little slice of cake.
Okay.
And just washed it down with some nice cold milk. Do you like drinking some milk as a refresher?
I do. I'm somewhat lactose intolerant. So if I just drink straight milk, sometimes it will make my belly kind of churn.
Sure.
But I do like that almond milk stuff now.
Yeah.
I'm not trying to be fancy or anything, but I do like that almond milk stuff.
Not when I'm like super hot.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about.
I'll grab a water and a Gatorade.
Yeah.
But, you know, after like doing a little bit of work outside of work, you know, doing something, I'm like, man, some ice cold milk sounds real good. Is that a Southern thing? Like,
yeah.
What about you, Joe? What do you think?
This is why you're both going to outlive me, because after like a day like that, I drink a beer and then I wash it down with another beer. No, I'm like Ivan. I can't drink milk. It doesn't do good with me that well. We don't even have, normally don't have it in the house. My 6-year-old can't drink it either. She's got to have almond milk.
Okay.
Normal milk just destroys her tummy.
Oh, well, I say that wrong. I buy that in, I'm not doing an ad for them. I'd love to do an ad for them. The Fairlife milk. I like that quite a bit. We like that a lot.
Also, like, it's almost like a late night. Before I go to bed, I'll love me a glass of milk too sometimes. Not a whole lot of milk, just, you know, but.
Do you ever make your own?
4174 Mantis,
yeah.
if you share that with me. And
good old fashioned like white milk, right?
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Not almond, none of that goat milk, none of that. Just some good old
none of that Franchi Smanchi.
Good old cow's milk.
What about you ever make your own milkshakes? Just get the chocolate syrup and
I do that
squeeze it over there.
I mean,
well, yeah, I'll get some milk and some ice cream, you know.
Yeah.
I love the Bluebell strawberry and homemade vanilla ice cream.
I've never had that. Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
That sounds amazing.
It's the best. And so I'll like, you know, dump some milk, dump some ice cream in there and a little bit of ice and make my own little milkshake.
See, that's a thing in my family, honestly, for my whole life. The only way I'll eat ice cream is I put a few spoonfuls in a glass.
Yeah.
And I pour a little bit of milk in there.
Yeah.
And whip it up just with a spoon.
Like a little milkshake thing. Yeah.
That's the only way I eat ice cream.
Super thick milkshake right there.
It is. Yeah. You just eat it with a spoon, but it's so much better for some reason to me than just regular.
I can see that. Yeah. Yeah. It makes it easier to eat too for some. Yeah. Yeah. My newest thing is I told you guys about it and it's not good. I wish I never would have discovered it. It's peanut butter and jelly on vanilla ice cream.
Oh, you did say that.
Yeah, it's like one spoonful of peanut butter.
That sounds delicious.
I'm telling you. I mean, there's no way it could fail. It's sugar on sugar on sugar. I mean, frozen sugar milk. But it is amazing. You mix it up just a little bit, and now it's like, man, my 70s aren't looking good.
I told you guys, like a couple weeks ago, my mom made banana bread.
Yes.
And so we talked about it on here beforehand. If banana bread ever happens, I'm going to try it. I took a slice of that banana bread and I slathered it with peanut butter and jelly and I ate it. And it was delicious.
Oh. I can't see how that would fail.
I mean,
that sounds amazing too.
It was awesome.
Yeah.
And she even had that like top coat of sugar, just crusted with sugar a little bit on top
keep
of the
talking.
Loaf.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. It was so good.
We need to do a side thing like a Donna Mantis cooking show.
Like a foodie show. Yeah.
Like it says we could call it like after school or something. We're like just after school kids, like making our own little snacks. Like, you ever do stuff like that when you're a kid? You just like, hey, I'm going to put cheese on this random thing. And
everybody has that little comfort thing.
Yeah, exactly.
Everyone made wife or go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, you better believe I washed that down with a nice glass of cold milk.
There we go. Yeah.
My wife's comfort food for her entire life. And we make it all the time. And I used to make fun of her. You just boil spaghetti noodles, drain them and pour in some tomato sauce and a little bit of salt and pepper.
Yeah.
That's it. Cause I always used to say like, why you're just halfway to
it's
spaghetti.
Like poor man's spaghetti kind of.
But if for some reason, it is incredible.
You know, it's kind of like tomato soup mixed with spaghetti.
Yes.
Yeah.
This is like, welcome to the Dawn of Mantis foodie episode.
There we go. There we go.
Anyways.
Yeah.
I love milk.
Yeah. I would drink it more if it didn't mess with my belly, but sometimes I'll be like, I'm just going to roll the dice on this one. Yeah. I mean, it's worth it, right? Yeah.
Yeah. You're playing Russian roulette
All
with your colon, man.
All it's going to do is just make me bloat and burp a few times. It's not even that bad. So I could do it if I wanted
That's
to.
That's true.
Yeah.
You had something else?
Oh, just from the hotline. Sally was saying that she found out today that a good friend of hers is related to the Casanova killer. You know, it was like in the 70s, he had like 18 kills.
Oh, yeah.
I just looked it up because I kind of remembered it just a little bit, but I kind of skimmed through it. 18 confirmed, but he said he had many, many more. Of course, you know, it seems like there's a tipping point on serial killers. It's like, I'm sure they look at all of it very carefully and then they just get the ones they can definitely prove.
Right.
You know, the psychology of that might be, and we don't have to go on a long tangent about this, but if you killed 18, wouldn't you want to take credit for more? I mean, what's it matter?
Right. Exactly.
By that, I mean, it's not like innocent of number 17. Oh, well, do I get to go free? No, there's the whole, you know, 15 other ones or whatever.
Yep.
So
it's like Otis Tool, the guy who I'm pretty sure is the one that killed John Walsh's son.
Brian Walsh. Yeah.
Or maybe he just, it's hard to remember. I may be wrong. Let me know on the hotline if someone knows, but he takes credit for every murder everywhere.
Okay.
I mean, I don't think he's alive anymore, but he used to take credit for hundreds of murders. He claimed all these, and like even ones that the police were like, there's no way.
Yeah.
You weren't even in that state.
Yeah. See, so once they get a certain amount, they could definitely prove. I'm sure they just go through it. They can get it over with. Right.
Yeah.
But, the 70s, I thought we might do an episode on the guy.
Yeah. I wrote it down.
70s. Cause it's not a super common one. I don't think.
No.
Probably in that area.
Yeah. I've heard about the Casanova killer, but it is definitely not a more well-known one.
Yeah. So, hey, we love the hotline. You guys, well, we hope you do. Call in for 417-4-MANTIS.
Yes.
The number 4-MANTIS and let us know what you got. It doesn't just ring in the middle of the night. You can leave a message. You can text it. We just check it like a day or two later.
Yeah.
So yeah, fill that thing up.
Cool.
Let's get it going. All right. Now to the episode.
John Thurman McCool was born on August 18th, 1913 in the town of Sheridan in central Arkansas. His parents were John and Racy, and he was the first of three children. His sister Marguerite was born in 1917, and brother George was born in 1918. Well, John would turn out to be an extraordinary person who would make the headlines of the paper several times throughout his life, beginning first time at the tender age of 7.
Whoa.
Yeah. This is when, in 1920, he and a friend named Gene McDonald were wading in a pond outside of town. Well, Gene had wandered ahead of John, and he fell into an old uncovered well that was hidden underneath the water's surface.
Okay.
John dove down and rescued his friend. He was hailed by many as a hero and was even considered for the Carnegie Medal of Heroism, whatever that is.
Okay.
So, yeah, he made the front papers and in 1920, saved this kid and just 7 years old.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Yeah.
Isn't it possible that this young man is a hero?
I know what I said, Gene McFadden. Donald!
It's a relative.
You shouldn't have saved him! No. The McCool family only spent the first part of John's childhood in Sheridan. Not long after that pond incident, probably 1921 or 22, John's father got a job in the clothing department of Isaacs and Dreyfus and Company. Now, this is a department store located in Pine Bluff.
Okay.
Although Pine Bluff is only about 20 miles from Sheridan, John Sr. decided it would be best to relocate there, and that's why they did when John was about 8 years old. So, we're going to deviate from the McCool story just for a second because, I mentioned Pine Bluff. Most of our listeners are not from around here. I get that. But I want to take a moment to talk about Pine Bluff.
Okay.
I hope it's entertaining for the people who aren't from around here, but it's really aimed at the people who are local and know what I'm talking about.
And now for a Dawn of Mantis sidebar.
There's definitely a reputation attached to that name.
Okay.
You guys know. Most Arkansans refer to it as Crime Bluff.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, today, Pine Bluff has a poverty rate of close to 30%. Back in the 90s, Time magazine ranked it as the worst place to live in America. Just last year, Newsweek ranked Pine Bluff as America's most dangerous small city with a crime rate of 5.6 per 1,000 people. Your chance of becoming the victim of a violent crime there is 1 in 61, and the odds of your property being stolen are 1 in 19.
Wow, that's high.
Even city council member Joni Alexander was robbed at gunpoint recently. Saw that on the news. Mm. On the citydata.com crime index, which ranks cities by number, like 1 being the safest and 1,000 being the absolute worst, Pine Bluff scored a 735. That's a crime rate 3 times higher than the national average and higher than 99% of all other cities in America.
I knew those numbers would be bad, but that's bad.
It's bad.
No. It exceeded my expectations.
I think we've went over that before. I think during Red Hall.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Maybe we've
talked
we
about yeah, we talked about the looking up the numbers for
sure.
crime rate and yeah. seeing how it is in the nation, how it sits.
But that 1,000 out of 1,000, there's 7-something. That's crazy.
Yeah. Well, it's also been ranked as America's fastest shrinking city due to the tens of thousands of people who have fled in the last few decades. Nearly 30% of the city has left since the 80s. The once bustling downtown area now looks like something out of an apocalyptic thriller. Nothing but empty streets and hundreds of abandoned buildings. Empty malls, schools, factories, and overgrown ball fields and lots cover the town. In fact, several historical buildings recently collapsed into the streets. You should look up the news clip on YouTube. They just fell down. They just fell over. Like bricks crumbled out into the street, and they just blocked the streets off. I don't know if they've cleaned it up yet. So yeah, I didn't make Pine Bluff sound great. It's not great, but Pine Bluff, it wasn't always that way.
Okay.
The city was incorporated in 1839, and not long after the railroad came through in the 1870s, Pine Bluff became a major hub of transport between the railroad and the Arkansas River, which runs along the city's northern border.
Okay.
However, in the 1920s, the city was hit by a massive flood, a long drought a few years after the course of the Great Depression. All right. A massive flood and a long drought. So it's had many ups and downs in its
sure.
history.
A lot of downs. It sounds.
The city would recover a few years later, though, when a huge munitions plant requiring 10,000 workers was constructed to supply American troops in the Second World War. There were many manufacturing and steel jobs as well. On the back of that prosperity, Pine Bluff was a fairly safe and decent place to live from the 40s all the way into probably around the 70s, maybe early 80s. But it seems like after that, businesses and corporations began leaving the city, and with them, most of the employment opportunities. This process increased when the then Arkansas governor, Bill Clinton, signed NAFTA into law, which would cause nearly 1 million American jobs to eventually be exported to other countries where labor is cheaper.
Yeah.
I remember that.
Yeah,
that NAFTA. It killed us. I think it's largely why we have so many empty factories in America now.
Yeah, it was definitely the beginning of that stuff.
Yeah. Well, then much of the funding for maintenance and improvement of the city's infrastructure was funneled away due to mismanagement and straight-up corruption by city officials, from what I found.
Okay.
So that's a little backstory on Pine Bluff. Now, back to John McCool. It's now the 1930s, and our boy John has graduated high school. He was very active in politics and became a member of the Young Democrats Club of Arkansas.
Okay.
He was also appointed to the Arkansas Agricultural, Mechanical, and Normal College. It's a weird name, but that's what it is. Board of Trustees by then-Governor Sid McMath. He met and married a fellow Pine Bluff resident named Hermione Moss in 1939. Well, he also joined the United States Navy and served in World War II in the early 1940s. He returned home a decorated veteran with 5 combat stars. So after the war, John's home now, and he forms the Office Supply and Equipment Company, which manufactured equipment used by the State Revenue Department for car titles, certificates, and registrations, meaning he had a direct contract with and was paid by basically the state of Arkansas.
I wonder if they had did that camera system that prints the IDs and stuff. I wonder if they had that way back then, you know, because that seems like something the DMV would buy from that company.
I don't know.
You know?
Yeah, this would be the, what, mid to late 40s?
Yeah.
Could be.
Yeah.
Well, the form of payment, this comes into play very soon. The form of payment that John's company got from the state, they were called warrants. Okay. Obviously, they're not like a warrant, you know, like what we're thinking about for sure. a prisoner. It was a state warrant. It's just think of it as a check.
Okay.
Yeah. You know, yeah. So we'll just
talked about them before, maybe.
We that seemed like
yeah. Yeah.
So let's just, when I say warrants from now on, just think checks.
No, I think cherry pie.
Tastes so good, make a grown man cry.
You're not getting that out of my head. Or the cabin one, wherever that's.
I love it.
Uncle Tom's cabin.
Yeah, there we go.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
John quickly became a prominent businessman in Pine Bluff and continued dabbling in politics. However, when Chancellor Frank Dodge ruled that State Act 214 prohibited members of state boards from selling goods to the state, John had to relinquish his spot on the AMR Board of Trustees. So you remember he was, that's the, agricultural, mechanical, and normal, right? Something like that? I don't know. He was on a Board of Trustees earlier.
Yeah, I gotcha.
And he had to be kicked off that, I guess, because it was like his own interests. Kind of like, you know, Nancy Pelosi being able to see different things and sell and buy stocks and make an incredible amount of money. But that just seems to be okay.
That's frowned upon, but not illegal.
Yeah.
Martha Stewart went, it's like insider trading. She went to prison for that.
She went to prison for, you got to wonder why all these politicians, they're in jobs that they get paid $110,000 a year and they're all worth $9 million.
Yeah, that needs, just made Martha Stewart a lot cooler.
It really did, because when she did the cooking show with Snoop, there's one of them that was a federal inmate.
Right.
And it wasn't Snoop.
No, it's the little old white lady.
Yeah. That was a good little show, though.
I loved it.
Yeah, it's really neat.
For more than a decade, John enjoyed a successful career and was revered by the community as a childhood hero. Remember, he saved that boy.
Oh, yeah, I remember that.
A war hero and prominent businessman. Then, this is where his picture on the True Crime Network or whatever goes from color to black and white.
Oh, yeah, they do that fade thing. Oh, man, I totally, yeah.
Or like negative. Yeah.
And they'll zoom in. Bill Hader mentioned this. They'll use that same photo over and over again.
Oh, yeah.
Sometimes they'll flip it and use it again and it'll slowly zoom into it.
That's where you're like, oh, you could only find two pictures of this guy.
Yeah, exactly. But you know what? I watched those shows for years and years until Bill Hader was doing a little funny thing about it. And I was like, wait, they are.
Yep.
But I guess you're just so into the case you don't notice.
Right. Yeah. Anyway, it works on the stupid shows.
It does work. So if we ever go video again, we need to remember that works. It doesn't matter. We'll just use the same photo over again.
Just imagine like some kind of, you know, ominous sound or music playing. Then came August 21st, 1956. That is the day state officials discovered that someone had forged state warrants totaling $85,000 and issued them to John's company. By the way, that's close to $1 million today. And that's serious.
Why did we just take a bite of lasagna right then or something? We're like, both like, we love true crime.
It's delicious. I'm just going to say these warrants that were forged totaled close to $1 million. Okay.
That's delicious.
A bookkeeper in the state treasurer's office noticed the forgeries after finding discrepancies in account numbers, and a bookkeeping machine rejected the warrants because they did not contain valid code perforations. Okay.
Okay.
It was discovered that some blank warrants had been stolen from the state auditor's office and the auditor's signature had been photographed and forged on them.
That's not good.
This is why suspicion fell on John. Obviously, because the fake warrants had been deposited into his company account, right?
Yeah.
That's a big thing.
You look, who would benefit the most from this?
Yeah. Probably the guy whose name was on them and received the money. We don't need this Sherlock Holmes.
Yeah. It's not exactly Sherlock Holmes.
But he didn't do himself any favors either, okay?
Uh-oh.
He had recently visited the auditor's office asking about procedures for processing warrants. Not only that, he also even asked if he could just, like, have some.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I know. He's like, can I just hear? He told
souvenir.
He told them that he was an undercover officer with the Arkansas State Police
Ooh.
And they were trying to set up someone or something. And for as a part of this investigation, he needed some blank warrants.
Okay. Yeah.
They did not give him any.
Yeah.
But it is thought that it was during that visit where they're like, we can't do that.
You know, like, all right. You know what they told him?
What?
You're going to have to get a warrant. To get one of these warrants? You better get a warrant.
Not without a warrant. So I'm thinking he was just like, you know what? Cool. And then they went to go get coffee or smoke or something, and he just stole them. He just...
Oh, wow. Yeah. Okay.
I don't know.
I'm not going to take no for an answer. He probably got mad and hit his hand on the counter and then the drawer opened like like on vacation.
Oh, yeah.
Except he didn't write a big check for him.
Yeah. So they discovered the money had been deposited into John's company account at the Simmons Bank in Pine Bluff, which is weird. I used to bank there.
Yeah.
Or I used to bank at Simmons and that was their regional like headquarters.
I had no idea that was that. Yep. It was their regional headquarters.
Yep. It's in Pine Bluff. So right after this, he immediately withdraws $3,750 in cash. Then he used part of the other money he deposited to pay off a few loans and also give his employees their paychecks. And when he gave them their paychecks, he was like, hey, you should probably try to cash these like right now. ASAP. So he said, just right now. Don't dilly-dally.
Yeah. Let's get these puppies through the system fast.
Well, by the way, those checks bounced.
Oh,
the scandal blew up immediately, and the very next day, John's wife, Hermione, don't you worry your face about it, Hermione. That was supposed to be...
Hagrid.
Hermione had a reporter knocking on the front door of the McCool house. Mm. John was not there, though, because he had to fly out of town for business abruptly. I think he, you know, knew.
Oh,
he caught wind of it.
He bailed?
Yeah, that's what he said.
Yeah.
That's what he told her, I got to bail. Well, it turns out John wasn't too far from Pine Bluff. He kind of lied. He didn't take off. He was spotted by some fishermen at a small lake just south of Pine Bluff that very afternoon. Just hours later, John stumbled through the front door of his house and collapsed on the floor. He had been badly beaten and was shot in the arm and covered in blood.
Wow.
He was rushed to a local hospital in Pine Bluff, and no sooner had John been admitted than the Grant County Sheriff, Vernon Hope, was knocking on his hospital door to serve him a different kind of warrant.
There we go. Yeah.
There we go. So John refused to say anything about the forgeries, the money, who had beaten him, who had shot him. He did not say a word.
Yeah, probably because he knew they'd come finish the job.
Right. I think it was a thing like, you're getting this time, and if you don't do whatever we want you to do, next time, you know, you're not coming home.
We'll kill your little wizard wife.
Due to his lack of cooperation, the investigation into whoever had beaten the shit out of him was dropped. I mean, if he's not going to give them any information, they're like,
okay, that's true. Yeah. Right. Yeah. How could they go on?
Right. But the other stuff was not dropped.
No.
He was charged with 3 counts of forgery and uttering. What it means in this case, first off, forgery is creating a forged document, and uttering is using said forged document with the intent to defraud.
Okay.
That's uttering, or at least that was the deal in the 1950s. So his attorney posted the $2,500 bail to free John until trial. He's out now. During that trial, on October 4th, John stood before Circuit Judge Henry W. Smith and pleaded guilty to all charges. Right? His lawyer, Reginald A. Albert Jr., said, isn't it possible? No.
Yeah.
Spoke of McCool's previously spotless reputation, his World War II naval combat record that earned him 5 battle stars, and the fact that he had 3 kids, the youngest of which was only 8 months old. Have some heart, Judge, please.
Did he talk about the save thing? That should be good, too. I mean, he should...
He didn't bring that up. I don't think so. He saved a young boy at 7 years old.
Yeah, I guess that's going a little far.
Yeah, that was 40 years ago, sir. Or whatever it was.
Yeah, that's true.
This did help, though, because John, he was facing 5 to 20.
Okay.
He got 5 years with 60 days... before going into prison to get his affairs in order. So, you're going to go in for 5 years. We're giving you 2 months to do whatever.
Which brings me to a point where I could talk about something that's frustrating. You know, we talk about blue collar crime versus white collar crime. Here's the thing. Like, if you defraud your company or a company or whatever, and you can directly see that that took the life savings of someone else, and you get 5 years for it, I'm going to tell you something. bullshit. And if it's five people, you know, and they give you 10 years, bullshit. Think about somebody that works somewhere for 45, 50 years and they're ready to retire or whatever, and they don't have that money there.
No.
I mean, you got to think it's the equivalent of like going up to them with gunpoint and say, give me all your money. Right?
Give me all of your security that you were going to have. Give me all of your life post-retirement.
Every day you woke up and looked at the alarm clock and thought, oh man, I don't want to go up here. I don't want to get up today, but I will because I'm going to save. You know, you think about that stuff. Yeah. I'll just go into retirement. That'll help me later, help my family. I'll leave something behind for my kids.
Yeah.
Just by doing the right thing every day. I mean, multiply that by however many victims there were. And if you get 5 years because you're a friend of somebody else that's rich or a friend of a judge or you got a good lawyer, bullshit.
And you're going to be out in 18 months, by the way.
Oh, they were a model citizen. Whatever. There's some big pansy that worked in an office. Of course they are going to be. They don't want to get hurt. So of course they're going to be like a model prisoner.
Yeah.
It drives me crazy to see this. Like, you see it all the time, suspended sentence or whatever, ruined countless lives in these big companies.
Yep.
I don't understand it. Like, the judge should be able to look at it like that. Well, you ruined 15 lives or whatever it was.
Yeah.
In a sense, I mean, I know it's just money, but it's bigger than that because it's what they've been working for so long.
And where did that money go? You know, can't they seize all his assets and liquidate him and then funnel that money back to the people he defrauded or something?
Sometimes, but you know, when you start messing with some of that stuff, it's like, it's not gaining the interest that it should have gained, you know? Yeah. So therefore the thing you were expecting, it's not there.
Yeah.
It's a super complex thing, but it's just, it just goes to show you like really how the system's stacked.
Right.
And if you're of some kind of status, it's going to be fine.
Of course.
Yeah.
On December 4th, Deputy Sheriff Buck Oliver delivered John to Cummins Prison Farm. The once proud, upstanding pillar of the community was now a broken man, head down and hands shackled. They probably weren't shackled. They probably just took him in there, but that's the way I pictured it.
Yeah. It was white collar crime, so maybe not.
Right. Just weeks later, the company he'd worked so hard to build was placed in receivership and listed for sale. John was a model prisoner. It's funny you said that a while ago. And because of that, as well as his reputation, plus the fact that it was not a violent crime, he just took a lot of money. John was released from prison. Yeah,
that people worked hard for. Keep going, though.
John was released from prison in August of 1958, less than 2 years after arriving.
That'll teach him.
Yeah. John wasted no time in diving right back into business, and soon he had rebuilt his company, and he became partner at an office supply and printing company in Pine Bluff as well. Not only did John work hard to rebuild his business, but also his reputation. He threw himself back into local politics, as well as several charitable causes. In 1960, then Arkansas Governor Orville E. Fulbus granted John a full pardon.
Okay.
John McCool had fought his way from a dirty prison cell back to his previous position as a respected businessman.
But this didn't last very long, Ivan.
Did he?
There it is.
But not for long. Just wait.
Well, on January 8th, 1962, John was supposed to travel to his native town of Sheridan, where he was born, as well as another nearby town of England, Arkansas, which I think we mentioned in the Red Hall.
Yeah.
Yeah. Series. Same neighborhood. He was supposed to meet with some customers, but later that day, they discover everyone realizes he had missed both those appointments.
Uh-oh.
Not like John. After he also failed to return home later that evening, his wife, Hermione, and a business partner named Dexter Young reported him missing to the Grant County Sheriff's Department. Due to the late hour, as well as a heavy snow that had fallen that same evening, the search for John did not begin till the next morning. That is when the Jefferson and Grant County Sheriff's Departments, as well as several volunteers, started searching roads and highways in the area. There was also an aerial search from a plane above, and heavy forestry equipment from the International Paper Company was utilized as well.
Okay.
I don't know how. Like, I wondered, what did they use heavy equipment? Just like plowing through the forest looking for, like, how did heavy equipment assist?
Yeah, I was trying to figure that out too. Maybe just something that could handle the terrain.
Because of the snow.
That way they could go. Yeah, that way we wouldn't get stuck.
All right, cool. Then on January 12th, 4 days after John went missing, a Sheridan resident named Wesley Hale went rabbit hunting 2 miles east of town. At the edge of the woods, where Hale usually hunted, was Hardin Cemetery. When Hale reached the cemetery around 1 o'clock that afternoon, he noticed a white 1960 Pontiac Bonneville partially covered in snow, parked there at the cemetery. It looked like someone was sitting in the driver's seat. When Hale approached the car to get a closer look, he discovered the dead, partially frozen body of a middle-aged man slumped over the wheel. It was John McCool. Hale alerted deputies, who soon showed up to process the scene. John had been shot in the chest 7 times with a .45 caliber weapon. Judging by the wounds and their angles, as well as the fact that the bullets had passed through his body, some of the bullets, and lodged in the driver's door behind him, they guessed that whoever killed John must have been sitting in the car with him when they fired the shots, close range.
Mm.
Other than Hale's footprints, the guy who found him, the snow around the car was undisturbed, so John must have been killed before the snow began on the evening of the day he'd gone missing.
I wonder if freezing temperatures messes up how the forensics comes out and determines time of death.
I wonder, yeah, because it kind of like pauses decomposition.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, that's why you put things in the freezer in the first place.
Yeah.
Interesting.
That's a good point, man. I didn't think about that. Like, someone...
And then that makes us, Dyatlov, that makes me think that some of that science was kind of messed up because of that too.
Yeah.
Because they'd be instantly frozen.
Yeah, exactly. And yeah, that has weird. To wreak havoc with time of death and stuff. But they, I guess mostly judging by the snowfall that had fallen on the day he disappeared, I don't think any snow had fallen in the 4 days previous.
Okay.
So since all that snow was undisturbed, they were pretty sure that he was, you know, the car was parked there and he was killed before the snowfall on Monday, January 8th.
And that's a good thing in itself too, in an investigative way, right? You would think, yeah.
Yep.
'Cause it actually kind of puts down the minimum time he could have been there.
Yeah. They know the day. I mean, you know,
yeah.
The snow helped a lot in that case.
Yeah.
Well, after John's death, the IRS received all but $2,000 of what was left of his estate for delinquent taxes. It was also discovered that several machines had been ordered 2 years earlier by Arkansas AM&N College under a blank contract with John, but they had never been delivered, and now they were just missing from John's company.
Mm.
This is a lot of, so I think he was still doing some weird stuff.
Well, I mean, in 2 years, he didn't totally get rehabilitated. I figured.
How's that possible?
2 years is a long time.
It wasn't even 2 years. It was like, that's 20
true.
Months or
that's
something.
Right. Yeah, that's true. Okay, keep going, sir.
Other than the initial clues, the snow and stuff, not much else was found. I haven't found any news of fingerprints or anything else, really. The story captivated the entire state for weeks, but the police stayed incredibly tight-lipped about the investigation. We do know that they submitted a couple guys to a polygraph. Both passed, and back in that day, it was like, you're free to go, sir. Right? The police also suggested John may have been carrying a large sum of money, hinting that simple robbery may have been the motive. However, many have since theorized that John may have had mob ties all along, even back to his 1956 fraud troubles and getting the shit beat out of him and getting shot.
I would slide a lot of chips in on that.
Mm-hmm. Me too.
I mean, it just totally makes sense. And then you take the fall and go to jail for a few years or less. And then... if you don't, you're not alive.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Jail sounds way better than...
Yes.
That. Yeah. I'll do it. So all these years later, no one has a clue who killed John Thurman McCool. He was buried in Graceland Cemetery in Pine Bluff, where he is still resting in peace today. And that's it. So I was going to ask you guys, what do you think happened? I think you already said it. I think he had some mob ties all the way back into the early 50s, probably, that went south. And then I think, you know... the first time he got beat up and shot, and he probably pissed him off again. And the second time it was night-night, right?
Yeah, that's kind of where I'm heavily leaning. You know, a lot of times in those cases, like you get involved in a mob type thing, and then it's like the next time it's a little bit of a bigger thing. And even if you're honest, like, well, I want out now. And it's like, okay, you'll just take the fall for that last thing. So then there's no getting out ever.
Ever.
Yeah. So then... I don't know. I just think that maybe they want him to do something else, or he couldn't steal quite enough to quench their money thirst. Mm-hmm. And that was, yeah. You were supposed to bring 25,000.
Yeah.
You brought 18.
Yep. Exactly. I mean, I would, like you said, I'd slide all my chips in on that.
Yeah.
Almost 100%. So yeah, that's what we think. Hey, what do you think out there, pod? Our pod, it is an awesome pod they rob. And then,
oh my gosh.
There we go. We need to redo that.
Yeah. We love you. Let us know what you think. 4174 Mantis Pod. We will catch you if that's all the business.
That's it. That's all I got.
We love you, Pod. Thank you again, once again, for listening to our ridiculousness. Good night.
Let me tell you about some fellas I know named Ivan, Sam, and Joe. They got themselves a little podcast, you know. And they talk about everything under the sun that they find interesting, spooky, or fun. And they sure ain't trying to impress no one. The remedy to too much time on your hands is take a little listen to the Dawn of Mantis. They talk about killers, monsters, and cults. French mates from hell, disappeared folks. Occasionally throw in a few dad jokes. They try to make every story extra nice by adding their own ginger spice. Not one time or two, but thrice. The remedy to too much time on your hands is take a little listen to the Dawn of Mantis. Now I'm sure these fellas will be around for quite a spell, 'cause there sure ain't no shortage of stories to tell, 'cause this old world's as weird as hell. But hell, even if nobody listens, they'd maintain a fine disposition, 'cause shooting the breeze is kind of their mission. The remedy to too much time on your hands is take a little listen to the Dawn of Mantis. The remedy to too much time